I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today we have with us our favorite economist, Joe Courtwright of Impresa Consulting. He's going to talk to us about a new project he's done called Walking the Walk that shows how homes in walkable neighborhoods are actually worth more money. And we'll talk to Suzanne Dirks from IBM. The company recently released its first Smarter Cities study about how technology can help cities lead the way to a prosperous and sustainable future. All that, plus the latest news from Planetizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The website walkscore.com is one of my favorite sites online. You enter the address of your residence, or any address for that matter, and it gives you a score based on the number of destinations that are within walking distance. While it's fun to see what's nearby and compare different addresses, my guest, Joe Courtwright, has dug deeper. He recently completed a study on behalf of CEOs for cities that takes a property's walk score and puts a dollar value on it. Joe, you're an economist and you follow residential real estate markets. It seems that the numbers and the headlines continue to scream gloom and doom, but your report, Walking the Walk, seems to indicate that there are some bright spots. Tell me what you found in your analysis.
Well, what we found was that consumers still very much value, and markets still value, houses and neighborhoods that have a high level of walkability to them.
Now, you said still value. I mean, is this a continuation of a trend? It doesn't feel like. Do you think people were intuitive about that in evaluating and assigning value to walkability?
Well, I think what it shows is that consumers look at all the choices that are available to them out in the marketplace. And houses that have higher levels of walkability, that are more convenient to a variety of destinations, turn out to be something that, whether they think about it in those terms or not, consumers and the market are attaching some value to.
And when you say walkability, explain what you mean. I know it was based on walk score.
Yeah, WalkScore is an algorithm, a Google Maps mashup developed by a nonprofit company up in Seattle called FrontSeat. And what it does is compute for any address in the United States the distance to the nearest several destinations, stores, parks, schools, libraries, coffee shops, banks, and so on. And so the WalkScore data is a good proxy for the number of destinations that are close at hand that one can walk to easily. And WalkScore rates every address in the United States on a scale of 0 to 100, where 100 is the most walkable, 0 is the most car-dependent. And we found that after you control for all the other observable characteristics of housing, the size of the house, how old it is, how many bedrooms and bathrooms it has, whether it's condominium or a single-family home, and after you control for neighborhood characteristics, things like income, whether it's close to the center of the region or on the periphery, whether there are a lot of jobs nearby or not, after you control for all of those other factors, walkability has a significant positive impact on housing values in almost every metropolitan area we looked at.
Joe, what something led you to think that walk score would correlate to housing value? What was that impulse that led you to this work?
For a long time, economists, when they think about cities, have noticed that rents tend to be higher in the center of cities. And there's been a puzzle about why would people pay more money to live close to the center. And the answer to that has been because people want proximity to destinations, that part of the real intrinsic advantage of cities is the level of variety and convenience of things to do and the easy ability to live your life, to meet friends and undertake a variety of daily activities. part of that is by automobile, obviously. But there appears to be a special premium for those places that make it easy to reach things by any mode and also to reach things that are within walking distance.
Can you give me an example of a couple of neighborhoods, one walkable, one not so walkable, in one of the markets that you looked at that illustrates the findings?
Sure. One of the metropolitan areas, and we looked at 15 different metropolitan areas around the country, one of the metropolitan areas that we looked at was Charlotte, North Carolina, which, as it turns out, is actually a pretty typical of the metropolitan areas that we looked at. And like every city in the United States, Charlotte has a mix of very walkable neighborhoods where there are a lot of destinations close at hand and other neighborhoods that are more car dependent. And the two neighborhoods that we looked at in detail in Charlotte were the Ashley Park neighborhood, which is typical of all the neighborhoods in the Charlotte metropolitan area. It has a walk score of 54, so that's sort of pretty much in the middle of the walk score range. And then we looked at another neighborhood called Wiltmore that has a higher than average level of walkability. It has a walk score as a neighborhood of about 71, which puts it at what we would call the 75th percentile of walkability. Not the most walkable neighborhood in Charlotte, but definitely an above average neighborhood. And what our model for those two places tell us is that all other things being equal, a house in Ashley Park would be worth about $280,000. That's the average walkable neighborhood. And if you were to take that same house and move it and put it in the Wiltmore neighborhood, the increase in value that you would get from the improvement in walkability would be about $34,000. It would be about a $314,000 house. So same house, all the same characteristics, controlling for all those other differences. Walkability, moving from the average walkable to an above average walkable neighborhood, would add about 12% to the value of a house.
So the houses are the same.
Right.
I mean, they have the same characteristics, same square footage or same amenities attached to them. And it's simply the walkability of the neighborhood that makes the difference, that makes that $34,000 difference.
Exactly. And what I should say is that our model looks at, you know, tens of thousands of transactions in every metropolitan area and uses something economists call hedonic pricing to estimate the value that's attached to each of the separate components of a house. How much value you attach to an additional bedroom or an additional square foot, how much impact the local neighborhood characteristics have on the house. And after you sort of separate all of those other effects and look at the effect of walk score, walk score has, in this case, that 12% premium of moving from a typically walkable neighborhood to one that's got an above average level of walkability.
Okay, this seems like huge news. In a market that is where home values are declining and homeowners are worried about how they're going to pay their outsized mortgages, and City Hall is worried about how they're going to hang on to property tax in a declining market. Is there some reason that we wouldn't want to be now intentional about adding walk value and walk score to neighborhoods and to individual homes?
Yeah, absolutely. And the folks at Front Seat have been working extensively with the real estate community to put walk score on real estate websites, and buyers are now looking at this information and considering it. But I think it's also a guide to public policy, because one of the things that it's telling us is that the consumers and the marketplace see a tangible value that's associated with these walkable neighborhoods. So if you're a city leader, if you're interested in, you know, preserving property values and enhancing the tax base of your community, those walkable communities or the walkable places in your community really do contribute to a real economic value.
I think this is extraordinary, because walking has clearly been undervalued as a characteristic of homes. I mean, it seems to me we've done everything in America for the most part to undermine walkability. It's certainly not considered particularly valuable as a transportation option, if it's considered as a transportation option at all. What led to the undervaluation of walking
over the years? Because it certainly seems obvious that we haven't valued walkability. I mean, there are a lot of places we build with no sidewalks. We build cul-de-sacs. We build all sorts of things that thwart walking.
Well, one of the things that I hasten to add about our findings is, while we've described it as walkability, and these are certainly much more walkable neighborhoods, they're really, in many ways, more convenient neighborhoods. And it doesn't even matter if you actually walk to all those destinations. Even if you drive everywhere, and people we know walk more in these neighborhoods, but even if they drive still a lot, they're driving shorter distances. Things are close at hand. And that convenience factor is a big plus. It also applies to transit. We know that the walkable neighborhoods, generally, transit works better because transit and walking are really complementary modes of transportation. Most people have to walk some distance to get on a bus or ride a train. So all of those things tend to go together. And the other factor that I think we're picking up with the walk score is the value that people attach to mixed use. Because the way walk score is computed, if you're in an area that's got a variety of uses, it has schools, it has shops, it has restaurants, it has banks, bookstores, and the like, it'll have a higher walk score. So those places that are the sort of monolithic types of places where it's just houses, for example, by definition will have lower walk scores because there's simply fewer destinations that one could walk to. And I think that's part of it. I think we got into this habit in the United States of separating out different land uses. We put all the houses in one part of the community. We put all the shopping in a few areas. We put the commercial and industrial centers apart from those. And I think that's one of the things that this is showing us, is that marketplace and consumers really attach a value to these vibrant mixed-use communities where one has a lot of transportation options, where things are more convenient, and where you have the opportunity to walk as well as actually walking.
This is a detail, Joe, but just so I understand walk score, does the walk score of my property increase as, let's say, more restaurants are concentrated near my home, or is it a matter of one restaurant being near my home?
Yeah, the way it's computed is there are 15 different categories of activities, and they include, and basically what walk score does is look for the nearest one of each of those 15 things. So if there's one restaurant within a quarter mile of your house, you get the points for a restaurant. And that's one of the things that we're interested in looking at, is does the effect of having even more choices in a particular category, and restaurants is a good example, does that have some added value? But one of the things we're pretty confident about is that this walk score measure, despite not being a perfect measure of walkability, really does separate out metropolitan level the most walkable places from the least walkable places.
Mm-hmm. So directionally, it's correct.
Yeah, we think it's could be more precise, but we know it's capturing most of the variation across neighborhoods in metropolitan areas.
You mentioned earlier this 12% premium that a house in Charlotte that has a 71 walk score gains over a house that has an average walk score of 54. Does that 12% differential hold in, you know, as you compare different pieces of real estate with that kind of change in walk score? Or give me a range. Help me understand what that range looks like.
Well, when we look at different metropolitan areas, and again, we looked at 15 different metropolitan areas, and for 13 of the 15, there was a positive and statistically significant increase in home values with an increase in walk score. In one metropolitan area, Bakersfield, there was no statistically significant relationship to walk score. And in one metropolitan area, it was actually negative in Las Vegas. So it doesn't hold everywhere, but it does seem to apply in almost every metropolitan area. And what we found is, on average, that an improvement in walk score in the typical metropolitan area was associated with between about a $700 and a $5,000 increase in home values. So a 1 point increase in walk score on that 100-point scale adds between several hundred and several thousand dollars to the price of a house, depending on the metropolitan area it's in.
And you made the point earlier, Joe, that part of what this increased value is reflecting is the fact that transit works better in more convenient neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are mixed use and have, you know, have lots of destinations. You also found, I think, in your study that the premium on walkability, the value on walkability was, or walk score, perhaps we should say, was greater in larger urban markets that are served by transit. Explain that.
The interesting thing is that, yeah, it's just as you pointed out, walkability or higher walk scores seem to be even more important in those cities where walking and transit are prevalent. So the highest scores that we observed were in places like Chicago and in San Francisco, where the typical walkable house had an even higher premium. And again, I think what that emphasizes is sort of the complementarity of options. Walkability is even more useful in those communities where you have more different kind of options for getting around, particularly the transit option. So those things are not exclusive. They're really additive. They reinforce one another.
But higher walk scores still was associated with higher home values, even in less dense cities like Dallas.
Yeah, you can look at places like Dallas, Fresno, Stockton, Tucson, and that's a range of large and small cities, but not places that, you know, have density or big transit systems. So, and again, I think there is this convenience factor that the places that have higher walk scores have, you know, these have mixed use. It's closer to get to stuff, and you have, if people aren't even actually walking, you have that option of walkability, which I think people view as an amenity, and it has a value in the marketplace.
You did an earlier study called City Advantage for CEOs for Cities, and it feels in some ways that walking the walk, this new study you've produced that correlates walk value, higher walk value with higher home value, is very much a continuation of that line of thinking that urbanness or density produces certain natural advantages that too often we don't take advantage of. Too often we let sort of slip through our fingers because of the way we develop our cities. Talk about City Advantage a little bit, Joe.
Yeah, City Advantage emphasizes the point that a big reason, a big economic reason for cities is the advantages that they provide to us as consumers, and by consumers I mean in the broadest sense, that we don't simply work in cities, which is usually the focus of economists, is, you know, are workers more productive in cities? But it's easier for us to carry on our lives. There are more goods and services to consume. There's a wider variety of choices that are available to us. There are more things that are close at hand. It's easier to interact with other people in cities because of density. And that's really in part what we're capturing with walkability on a very small scale, is those places within cities, those neighborhoods and those houses that offer a wide set of choices, that offer variety, and that offer convenience, the ability to get there on foot, by bike, using transit, and of course by automobile, and offer lots of choices nearby, are places that are advantageous to people as places to live, to interact, to have social activities, and so on. And that's something that, as we think about the future of cities and how we develop cities, is an asset that we need to figure out how we build upon, because it makes cities work better.
If you're a mayor, a city planner, or someone trying to influence those people, and you read Walking the Walk, what would your public policy prescription be?
One of the things that I think we want to look really hard at is this issue of mixed use, because sort of the dominant paradigm of planning and zoning for a long time has been to segregate out different kinds of land uses. Essentially, we don't have corner grocery stores in part because in a lot of neighborhoods it's simply illegal to have commercial uses on any corner. They have to be outside those residential neighborhoods. And then I think as we think about development, we want to look at neighborhoods as, you know, places where people have the opportunity to do a lot of their interactions, a lot of their business on a fairly small scale. One of the things that the City of Portland is looking at is what they call 20-minute neighborhoods. You know, are all the things that you want to do within 20 minutes of your house by a variety of modes of transportation. So I think it's an interesting way to think about the way we arrange activities within cities. And that's really something that's primarily the responsibility of local governments.
One last question, Joe. It feels like this is one more example of the sort of the old paradigm of cities being broken. The 1950s vision of cities being broken or demonstrated to be out of touch. And we clearly need to be moving to something new. Where are the big, sort of the big lines of new thinking that you see that will lead us toward what we ought to be doing and how we need to change the future of cities?
I think a lot of it is thinking about cities as giving people choices and how we give people more options. And you can think about a walk score as measuring sort of the number of options for activities that are close at hand. You can think about walking and King and Transit as all optional ways that people can use to get around. So cities should be places, if they work well, that give lots of people lots of different choices and promote easy interaction. And, you know, that takes us back to what I think Jane Jacobs said, you know, decades ago about the essential function of cities as, you know, throwing people together and giving them lots of opportunities for easy interaction, because that enriches our lives, it produces the new ideas that help drive our economy, and it makes things more interesting.
Joe, thanks so much for, again, being our guest on Smart City. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Carol.
Joe Courtwright is an economist with Impresa Consulting. His latest study on behalf of CEOs for Cities is called Walking the Walk. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
San Jose, California is getting closer to becoming the first energy-independent city in America. It's on its way to deriving all of its energy needs from renewable resources, much of which will be locally produced. USA Today reported on the city's plans to reduce its per capita energy needs and meet its diminished demand solely through renewable energy sources. Much of that renewable energy is planned to come from biogas, a methane-rich power source generated by converting 100% of the city's waste into energy. The biogas facility proposed to perform this energy conversion would be the largest such facility in the U.S. As the city moves forward with these plans for energy independence, other cities are sure to be watching closely. Meanwhile, two of America's biggest cities are also looking to try something new. Following on the success of bike-sharing systems in cities like Paris, Barcelona, and Montreal, the American cities of San Francisco and New York are taking baby steps towards implementing similar systems here in the States. But Americans are a bit slower to embrace bike sharing. On a recent weekend, officials in San Francisco brought out a sample of the proposed system to the city's main park. With only 7 bikes, the trial was not exactly a good representation of the ubiquitous systems those other cities have, but it gave some residents an idea about how the plan might work. And in New York, operators of bike-sharing technologies will be demonstrating their systems to New Yorkers this summer during 3 weekend street closures in the city. Officials there hope that by showing people how the systems work, they can generate the public interest and political will to make bike sharing a reality. And there's been a lot of talk about Detroit lately, but the problems there go beyond city borders. They're even crossing international lines. Just across the Detroit River sits the Canadian city of Windsor, Ontario, which some are now calling the Detroit of Canada. Due to its proximity to Detroit, Windsor was also a big auto manufacturing town, and the downfall of the American auto industry has crippled the Canadian city. According to a recent report from The Economist, Windsor now has the highest unemployment rate in Canada, at more than 14%. Despite its location in Canada's biggest provincial economy, the pains of the U.S. economy are playing a bigger role in determining the health of Windsor. Until the U.S. economy gets back into shape, Windsor is likely to remain one of the hardest-hit cities in Canada, just like its American counterpart across the river. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll look at Europe's smart cities with Suzanne Dirks from IBM, who joins us to talk about the company's look at how technology can build smarter cities. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My next guest is Suzanne Dirks. She leads IBM's Global Center for Economic Development, and she's been working on a major initiative there called Smarter Cities. Of course, here at Smart City, we think we know what smarter cities are, but Suzanne's work shows how cities are leading the way to a prosperous, sustainable future, and how technology can help transform the systems that make cities work. Suzanne, we've all seen the IBM ads on smarter cities. We've been talking about smart cities here on this show for almost a decade. Describe what IBM means by smarter cities, and how do you know a smarter city when you see it?
What we have seen in relation to cities is that cities have undergone a lot of change over the last couple of years. So there has been dramatic change in terms of economics, in terms of politics, in terms of technology, and cities have become more empowered, but they also have got a lot more responsibility. So it's about addressing that responsibility and taking that power and using technology basically to make cities more smart and respond to that new power and that new responsibility. So an example, obviously, is the whole environmental area, the area around sustainability. You're faced with finite resources, and you need to deal with finite resources and make best use of finite resources. So smartness in the eyes of IBM is one way of doing that. So basically, from a technical point of view, you're then looking at, can I leverage all the data that are out there that I can measure to get better resource utilization? Can I maybe interconnect the systems out there to better understand how the different resources relate to each other and how to better use those resources? And then add some intelligence and basically optimize the use of resources.
If I'm a user of a smarter city system, and let's stick with environmental systems for a minute, what is it I know and am able to do or decide as a result of having a smarter system that serves me?
As a user, for example, we could take the example that you're somebody, a citizen like myself, that travels to work every day, and you're faced with a lot of congestion every morning. So there's a lot of wasted hours, there's wasted time, there's frustration, etc. So if I then look at one of the systems that we see a city made up of, which is the transport system, how do I make that more smart? What kind of data can I look at to make it more smart? And there's a lot of data that are available out there. In terms of transport, it could be data on, you know, which how many people travel at what time, on which train, on which public services, how many cars are entering the town, etc. So there's a lot of sensors out there that can give you that data. And you then bring together the data from all these different sources. And all that hasn't been available before. A lot of that information is just only becoming available now. And you interconnect that information. And then you use that information to make some intelligent decisions in terms of, for example, introducing congestion-based charges to a city in terms of different charges for different hours depending on the traffic, etc.
Let's stick with the transport system for a minute because I think it's such an interesting one. There are, let's say, just as you've described, there's information embedded in the transport system or that could be embedded in the transport system through technology and infrastructure that would then help you be smarter, as you say, for instance, about pricing, the times at which people travel. However, one way to make the transport system smarter is to change land use so that people don't have to make such long trips. So obviously, IBM is primarily a technology company and believes in technology solutions. That makes plenty of sense to me. But how do you account for those other decisions that really impact how much people have to travel?
That's a very good point, Carol, because especially in transport, okay, we have the congestion challenge, we have the challenge around pollution, but there's also the challenge around excessive land use, especially if you have a car-based transport system, which is particularly relevant in developing countries. So really, that brings me back to a more general point, and that's when we looked at cities and trying to develop a conceptual framework for cities to, you know, break down some of the complexity. What we came up with is six key systems. And that's one way how you can split it. I'm sure there's more ways of splitting it. But as part of these six systems, which were transport, communication, people, business, water, energy, each of those systems has challenges. But more importantly, there is a system of systems. So really, you know, to solve the transport problem alone, it doesn't really make sense. You have to look at the bigger picture and what impact one decision has on the other decisions. And there's loads of those interconnections. Obviously, if you make a transport decision, that will have impact on your people system. It also will have impact on your business system and, you know, in terms of attracting business. It will have impact on your communication system. But some of the other systems actually have impact on all the other five. So there's a high level of interconnectedness between those systems.
You know, I think it's interesting as you talk about interconnecting the systems and the information so that the end user, the decision maker, can make better decisions. Obviously, there are a lot of assumptions that are built into the decision-making model, right? I mean, you're making certain assumptions about things that are good and what good things produce, et cetera. I mean, I'm curious about this, Suzanne, because I see this a lot in research. I mean, in the simplest form, we see a lot of best cities to live in. You've got one of those lists on your website, actually, the Smarter Cities website. But there are certain assumptions that underlie the choices of the top 10. How transparent do you make those assumptions so that people can see what you judge as a good decision is supported by a number of assumptions that you've made? I mean, how transparent are those assumptions?
Transparent to the end user, they're transparent to the client, naturally enough, because when we work with clients, obviously it's their requirements we want to fulfill. For example, we have an offering where we have an assessment tool where cities can assess how smart their cities is, and we are currently further developing that tool. But basically what you do as part of applying that tool and measuring the smartness of a city is to talk to the city and look at, first of all, you know, what is your overall makeup in terms of, you know, demographics, social aspects, environmental aspects, etc., and use those questions in a structured way to draw out some of the priorities. And then together with the priorities, you can then make some decisions that will, you know, influence that assessment that you were mentioning in terms of setting the parameters. So that has to be done together with, but declined effectively.
In your view, which cities are smarter cities and why?
That's a tricky question. I think there's no final answer to that. There will be some cities that are smarter in different aspects. So if we stick to the transport example, I think Stockholm obviously is an example of a really interesting smart city in terms of having innovated their transport system through the introduction of congestion charging, which had benefit not only on the financial side, which has reduced the basically the emissions by 14%, which boosted inner city retail by 6%, which reduced inner city traffic by 25%, and which was also self-financing. So I think that's one example where a city has been smart on the transport front. Then you see other cities that have done, you know, Malta is another example around energy and water that have been very smart in those areas. So it really depends, you know, so different cities will have different strengths and be smart in different areas. The ideal scenario is obviously to have that city that is smart in all areas. I haven't come across that yet. I think that's still in the future, and that's still a challenge, but there are certainly cities that are very strong in individual areas and more than one individual area and that are starting to connect the dots and you know, see the interrelationships between the systems.
Well, as you see cities that are excelling in one or more areas, and you mentioned Stockholm, for instance, on transport, what got them there? What are the qualities of Stockholm that allowed them to get to that point of being really smart about transport?
It's hard to generalize, but it's probably a mixture of the pain of the problem, but then obviously much more important, it's driven by a vision and wanting to do that. And stepping back, and that's part of our recommendations in the paper, stepping back from the immediate problem and saying, okay, I have a transport issue. Now, what's my vision? What would be the ideal scenario? And developing that vision or that dream and then building the bridge to that dream in terms of what's the immediate practical solution that will get me close to that. So it's that vision, having that vision and translating that vision into a strategy, into a plan.
Do you find that with the extreme financial pressure most cities all over the world are under today, are they more or less likely to be thinking long term today?
It's hard, once again, to make a general statement, but it's really like the same as what you can see at a country level. A lot of cities are starting to look at infrastructure and the impact that infrastructure, and I mean that in the widest sense, can have on economic development in terms of making a city able to function more competitive, more efficient, and so see it as a key strategic investment and maybe even creates new industries for a city. So many cities are starting to see that. But of course, you know, it would be naive to say there are no financial constraints. That's obviously still an issue and a challenge.
One issue that is very much on the minds of people today is food safety. And I was interested to see that IBM is addressing that concern, too. Explain how technology can make the food supply safer.
Yeah, that's more about the tracking of food. We have solutions around tracking the food and basically tracking it back to the source and seeing the different stages. So it really goes back to this idea, you know, that you measure data, that you collect data from different data points, bring them together, analyze them, and make some decisions on the basis of that. But I wouldn't be the expert on that particular solution, no.
What level of commitment does a city have to make to adopt some of what you view as smarter city solutions? In your view, is this an all or nothing proposition? I mean, can you stick your toe in the water or do you really have to jump in?
Good question. No, I think you can stick your tail into the water, as you call it, and start it in small steps. As I said, I think you need to look at the whole picture and look at it in terms of the full six systems and how they're related and set your priorities. So you have to take a little bit of a top-down strategic approach right at the beginning. But then you can say, within my transport system, or say within my people system, to take different examples, especially around health and aging population, I have a particular issue that I want to solve. And then, you know, develop a solution in that area and work it from there and see what impact does it have if I make that area more smart, and then maybe how can I use that solution in the next steps to make aligned areas, similar areas more smart. So it's certainly possible to do it step by step, and to even take it one step further down the ladder. I have this smart cities assessment. So that can be a first step, you know. So if you just want to find out how smart am I as a city, or how smart is my water system, or how smart is my energy system, you can just look into that particular aspect and gain some insights into that. And then you can decide, you know, is how much of an issue is that, and how do we want to address that?
One of the things that we found in our research is that almost 60% of any city's success can be explained by the presence of college-educated people in the population. In other words, it's almost as if you're not working on increasing the number of college graduates in your population, you're probably not working on what matters. Where does that factor into your formula for smarter cities?
Yeah, I think education is an absolutely key part, and it would fall into the people system in our case, because the people system is really about the citizens and the consumers and the users of a city's infrastructure. So that includes public safety, includes health, but it also includes education. So yes, definitely education we would see as a key part of a city's mission and increasing the value of a city.
You've looked at cities through a technology lens, I suppose, or through a technology solution lens for a long time. Is technology, in your mind, the silver bullet for cities?
It's certainly not the only solution, and I don't think that's our approach totally. All we're saying is you need to leverage technology. It's there, and it could be, you know, and it's not so much the technology, it's actually the data. A lot of the data are there, and that's what you really should leverage, and the fact that data are interconnected and available to you. So it's not so much about the technology. Technology helps you, but it's the data and the information that you want to leverage.
So technology is simply a means of collecting that data, connecting it, and then understanding what it means.
Indeed. It has to be, of course, it has to be business-driven. And as I said earlier on, you have to start with looking at what makes me different as a city. Where are my issues? Where are my goals? That's your starting point. It's a pure business starting point. But then technology is part of the solution. But it's certainly not the only part of the solution.
Does deployment of technology typically reduce operational cost or increase them? I mean, is this an added investment you make because you can be so much smarter in your operations, or does it actually reduce operating cost?
The aim definitely would be to reduce operating costs, and that's the only way you can, I think, convincingly argue the case in the current economic climate. So that has to be one benefit that comes with it. But it's not only about cost reduction, it's also about deriving some additional benefits. And as I said, Stockholm there is a good and easy example. You were reducing the costs, reducing pollution, and reducing the use of fuel, etc. But you were also adding some new value by increasing retail, by increasing the quality of life, by improving maybe the quality of air and things like that. So it's both sides. It's the cost side as well as the benefit side.
I want to change the subject for a minute. You are in Ireland. Ireland was only recently considered to be the European economic miracle, importing lots and lots of talent because the nation simply couldn't keep up with the demand. And now the economy has cooled considerably, and I've read that talent is leaving Ireland. From your perspective on the ground there, what is happening and why?
Ooh. A completely different question. You know, I think it goes back to the main point. Talent goes there where there is exciting work. And if the level of employment goes a little bit higher in one country, people might leave that country. But I'm not positioned to say what the exact cause is, but that would be my conclusion, you know. So people, as you and Richard Florida, etc., always argue, you know, talent goes where interesting work is, where there's a good quality of life, a good standard of living, and that's the natural pull.
What should cities be taking seriously that you think they're giving too little attention to today? What are those issues that are underappreciated?
I think the biggest one is around environment. And that's a personal opinion, of course, between the six systems. I think the transport system and the water system and the energy system are really the key ones, because all of them are very much about sustainability, and all of them are about, you know, we have now reached a point where we are really in danger of having explored everything we can explore and have reached a point, you know, where things get worse if no actions are taken very, very quickly.
And yet there seems you can't pick up a newspaper, you can't pick up a magazine, you can't pick up any publication written for mayors and not see the environment mentioned. Are we simply not acting on the information, or do you think there's just we just don't appreciate the urgency of the issue?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Some of it is definitely not acting with the urgency that is required. And I think the other more difficult one is because of the complexity. To solve one problem, you might cause problems in other areas. So really, it's not that easily fixed. It's, you know, there are no real quick solutions to it. But I think a lot of actions are happening at various ends. It's just, you know, it's a big job. It can't happen in one day.
Where do you see the most sophisticated response by cities to the question of climate change and the environment?
I think it's a question that's difficult to answer generally. You see a lot of good action in the US, but equally you see a lot of good action even in the developing countries. But, you know, the challenges in the developing countries are different, so the solutions tend to be different, and what can be achieved with the solutions is different. So I don't think there's a general answer, but there is a lot of interesting initiatives springing up in different parts of the world. And we actually, and if I just can refer to some other research we did, we had the CEO study last year, at the end of last year, and one of the areas where we looked at some of the questions were around the whole area of reacting to green corporate social responsibility. What was interesting there was to see some of the level of involvement by some of the developing countries in particular. So there were some real countries coming out really, really strong in that area and making that a priority.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, tell me where you see. You said there are lots of interesting things going on. Tell me about some of them. I think that it's always interesting, again, if we can imagine concretely what certain cities are doing. So I'd love to hear about any interesting experiments that are on your radar screen.
Yeah. Well, let me take an Irish one, actually, and that refers to the whole area of water. And water is, as I said, it's one of the systems. It has a lot of challenges in terms of water supply, water sanitation, water quality. So one of the solutions that we have implemented here in Ireland, in Galway and in the west of Ireland, is actually a system that measures the water quality. So sensors were introduced to measure the water quality and basically use that information to make some decisions and distribute that information to different agencies that can use that information in different ways. So Ireland is very pioneering, or this particular initiative has been very pioneering in that space, which has now attracted interest from other European countries, because there's also this European Water Framework Directive, which basically sets down some regulations about data that need to be collected and monitored. So other countries and cities are seeing the benefit of that. So that would be one example.
Suzanne, I appreciate very much your being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you very much, Carol.
Suzanne Dirks leads the Global Center for Economic Development at IBM. She joined us from RTE Radio in Dublin, Ireland. Finally this week, crisis can often spark outrage, but our City Views commentator Walker Smith gives us some insight on ways to keep your cool.
China has a novel worry about today's global recession, and that is whether its GDP growth this year will be enough to stave off civil unrest. Worker strikes are common in China. The magic number for the Chinese government for GDP growth is 8%, the level necessary to stay even with growth in the Chinese workforce, and thus the level needed to create enough jobs to avoid discord, protest, and riots. Employment is not just the fundamental underpinning of economic well-being, it is the linchpin of social stability as well. As longtime Atlantic Magazine correspondent Robert Kaplan noted in a recent essay about the December 2008 riots in Greece, while the riots were triggered by the fatal shooting of a student by a police officer, the resentment that flared was rooted in long simmering frustrations among Greek youth, chief among them a youth unemployment rate that runs 25% to 30%. Perhaps it seems a bit extreme to suppose that workers in the UK or the US or Western Europe might revolt, but it's actually not that far-fetched. Just this past March, French workers facing layoffs at a Caterpillar factory grabbed international media attention by holding managers hostage in order to force negotiations about the planned job reductions. This was the third such incident in France this year. In January, French unions staged a general strike to protest the government's handling of the recession, followed in mid-March by a general strike along with demonstrations by 1.2 million people across more than 200 French cities and towns. Of course, the French are notorious for taking to the streets in protest and strikes, but what's going on in France is more than the typical demonstration to blow off steam. In early February, Dennis Blair, the new United States Director of National Intelligence, testified to Congress that instability caused by the global economic crisis has become the biggest security threat facing the U.S., outpacing terrorism. In addition to China, Greece, and France, high unemployment has prompted protests and strikes in Indonesia, Latvia, Bulgaria, Chile, Iceland, and Britain, as well as the island nations of Reunion, Guadeloupe, and Martinique. No place is safe from protesters in the streets, not even the U.S. In early December, Chicago workers at Republic Windows and Doors seized the factory and staged a six-day sit-in that ended only after the workers secured a severance deal that averaged about $7,000 per worker. The millions paid in bonuses by AIG provoked outrage when reported in March, the height of which was a group of angry protesters who organized a bus trip with reporters in tow to air their grievances in front of the homes of two of the executives receiving bonuses. Tea Party demonstrators took to the streets on tax day to protest the administration's handling of this crisis, and Daily Show host Jon Stewart tapped into a different vein of outrage by mocking the overhyped financial coverage of CNBC and extracted an apology from Mad Money host Jim Cramer. Now, not every recession or financial crisis rouses people to take to the streets, but severe crises often have this effect. The 1930s were a period of enormous political turmoil both in the U.S. and around the world, largely because of worldwide economic meltdowns that kicked off that decade. During our current economic downturn, people will look for outlets to vent their frustration and indignation. While no revolution is in the offing, a big change in the public mood has set in and will persist for the foreseeable future. The challenge is for us to keep our cool and to help others keep theirs, thus channeling this sour mood into constructive change that avoids the kind of counterproductive overreaction that is often the self-destructive result. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelevich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. That's it for this week's show, but if you want more Smart City, go to our website, smartcityradio.com, where you can listen to archived shows, read my blog, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our musically inclined producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.